From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Brian Wilson celebrated surfing and the records he made with the Beach Boys, but Wilson was afraid of the ocean. That's one of many paradoxes surrounding the relationship between the Beach Boys and Southern California. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Timothy White, author of a new book about the Beach Boys and the Southern California experience. And we hear an excerpt of a 1988 interview with Brian Wilson. Also, we meet the co-creator of 30-something and My So-Called Life, Ed Zwick. He directed the new film, Legends of the Fall. And linguist Jeff Nunberg thinks about a subject that depresses him, adverbs. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The music of the Beach Boys in the 1960s celebrated the idea of teenage fun in an endless California summer filled with surfboards, hot rods, and pretty girls. Timothy White has written a new book about the Beach Boys and their real and imagined connections to the history and subcultures of Southern California. The book is called The Nearest Faraway Place. Before we meet White, we're going to hear an excerpt from a 1988 interview I recorded with Brian Wilson. He was the genius of the Beach Boys, the songwriter, producer, and lead singer. Wilson has come close to being one of rock and roll's casualties. In 1964, he had the first of several nervous breakdowns and retired from performing, but continued to write, record, and produce. His weight ballooned, and he became a recluse. For several years, he was under the 24-hour care of his psychologist, Dr. Eugene Landy, who was described by some as a miracle worker and by others as a Svengali and opportunist who exploited his relationship with Wilson. This is one of Brian Wilson's Ballads of Alienation, the song I Just Wasn't Made for These Times.
I keep looking for a place to fit in where I can't speak my mind. And I've been trying hard to find the people that I won't leave behind. They say I got brains, but they ain't doing me no good. I wish they think I got something good going for myself, but what good?
In 1988, Brian Wilson reemerged with his first solo album, and he went on a publicity tour accompanied by his psychologist's assistant. During that tour, I spoke with Wilson about the Beach Boys' early years. You've said that your early sound was influenced by the Four Freshmen.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of people would have thought of the Four Freshmen as being a really square group in their harmonies. What did you really like about them?
What did I like?
Mm-hmm.
I liked the way they blended their voices, you know, the sound they made as they blended their voices. I thought they were great. I didn't see anything wrong with the Four Freshmen at all.
What else did you listen to when you were young?
I listened to Rosemary Clooney and the Four Freshmen and just different people, you know.
How did you start singing in falsetto, and how did you figure out that you could have a falsetto voice?
Well, because I used to practice the freshman with the high voice in the Four Freshmen. And his name was Bob Flanagan. And I practiced along with him. Whenever I'd hear freshman songs, I'd sing along with the high note, you know. And I got into a habit of singing high. And when the Beach Boys came along, I just took that that habit of mine, that habit, bad or good, just a habit of singing high, you know? So then I started saying, hey, I sound like a girl up here. So I got into it. I got into it, you know?
The first songs that you wrote and recorded were surf songs. Now, you'd never surfed yourself, right? What was the inspiration for writing surfing songs?
My inspiration for writing surfing songs goes back to my brother Dennis, who drowned, of course, in 1983, in December of 1983. He asked me if I would be interested in writing a song about surfing. Hold it. excuse me, I had a yawn. And I said, sure, I'll try it. And I tried it. And about a month later, we were on the Los Angeles charts, on the Los Angeles charts with surfing, you know?
You were actually afraid of water yourself, right?
Oh, yeah, I have an aversion to water. I don't know what it is. I don't know exactly what it is. Could be that I think I saw somebody drown in a pool once. This guy drowned, and I saw the ambulance come get him at the, you know, and I was it kind of scared me to death. And I think that turned me off to water.
Do you know how to swim?
Do I know how to swim? Oh, yeah, I swim all the time.
Oh, okay.
In Los Angeles. In Malibu, where I live, I go swimming all the time.
So you're not that afraid of water?
No,
then?
No, no.
Oh, okay.
But I still have a little bit of a fear of it, especially the ocean.
Did you have to pretend like you were a surfer when the Beach Boys first got started?
No, not at all. Mm-mm. We didn't play the role of surfers. We sang about surf and girls, but we did not, whatever.
I want to play one of your early surf records.
What song is that?
This is Catch a Wave.
Catch a Wave, oh,
okay.
Yeah.
The production on this is just terrific. There's a harp, there's an organ, great touches on it. Just say a little bit about how you produced this record.
Catch a Wave?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was Michael and I wanted to do something where we would display the high voice, mm-hmm. the medium voice, and the bass voice. All in one record, you know, at different intervals, you mm-hmm. know what I mean? Not all at once sometimes, but separate from each other, you know? And it starts that, don't be afraid to try the great, that's the bass part, right? And then, da, 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 was my voice. And then Mike went, da, 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 and then he was in the middle, too. So he sang bass and middle, and I sang high.
What about the instrumentation?
The instrumentation was just two guitars, a piano, drums, and a harp, and stuff like that.
Okay. Let's hear it. Catch a wave.
Catch a wave and you're sitting on top of the world. Don't be afraid to try the greatest sport around.
Catch a wave. Catch
Everybody
a wave.
Those who don't just have to put it down.
You paddle out, turn around and raise, and baby, that's all there is to the coastline.
Catch a wave and you're sitting on top of the world.
Not just a bet, cause it's been going on so long.
Catch a wave, catch
always
a wave.
No one's
they said it wouldn't last too long.
They'll eat their words with a fork and spoon and watch them. They'll hit the road and I'll be surfing soon. And when they
catch a wave, they'll be sitting on top of the world.
I don't know if you listen to your old records very much, but what goes through your mind when you hear that?
Well, a lot of stuff. When I hear old records, it just flutters through my mind. You mean in as far as my opinion of what it sounds like or my sentimentality to it?
Both.
Well, I feel more artistically aware than sentimental, you know. My first reaction is usually an artistic, like, oh, I think my voice flattered. I wish I had just taken a few more minutes to get it right in the studio, you know? You know, young and impulsive, right? Young and restless. Want to get through, want to get out of here, want to go swimming, want to go to a movie, you know? So that's how it used to happen to me. And then the sentimental value would creep in, and I think, oh, gosh, you know, how could I have made a record that great, you know? And that kind of thing crosses my mind, too. So there's artistic criticism, self-criticism, and then there's sentimentality. Those two ingredients go into that.
What about thinking back to how you felt at the time you recorded it?
Oh, well, the way I felt, you mean? Well, it was kind of like when I was in my 20s, or early 20s, I was full of energy, right?
Uh-huh.
I mean, I darted around. I could do anything. I could produce a record. I could go to a movie. I could go running. I could do anything. You know what I mean? When I was in my early 20s, I was a real bombardier. I mean, I was really a hustler, you know?
And now?
And now? I've slowed down a little bit, but because I've been exercising so much lately, I'm getting my second wind in life. You know what I mean? It's not like being 22 again or 24, but it's still odd. You know, you go through these trips in your life where how old are you?
37.
37?
I always have to think.
Gosh, I mean, can you remember what it's like to be 22? It's just
a little bit, you
can sort of remember, but like when you get a little older, you sort of slow down a little bit, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's the one thing I don't want to do is slow down because I don't want to die. So I'm going to keep going real fast.
Brian Wilson recorded in 1988. My guest Timothy White has written extensively about Wilson and the Beach Boys. He first interviewed Wilson 20 years ago. White is the editor-in-chief of Billboard and former senior editor of Rolling Stone. His new book is called The Nearest Faraway Place, Brian Wilson, The Beach Boys, and the Southern California Experience. Wilson is recording again. In fact, Timothy White brought with him a couple of tracks from forthcoming CDs that have not yet been played on radio. Let's hear one of them. This is Sweets for My Sweet from a forthcoming CD called Till the Night Is Gone, paying tribute to the late songwriter Doc Pomus. It'll be released in about a month on Rhino Records.
Sweets for my sweet, sugar for my honey, your tasty kiss thrills me so. Sweets for my sweet, sugar for my honey.
Timothy White, when was the last time you spoke with Brian Wilson?
About a week ago.
How is he doing? What is his mental and physical health like now?
He's in a much happier place than he's been, I'd say, in 15, 20 years. He doesn't have any Svengalis around him anymore, any psychiatrists who write songs with him. He's on a much more even keel in terms of his work and the projects that are laid before him. I mean, he went through a rough time recently, but he's at a happier place because he has more personal autonomy now than he's had in the longest time.
Is he living like a hermit now? Or
No. He's living right in Los Angeles, and, you know, he has a girlfriend, and he comes and goes as he pleases. And it's funny, there was a thing in the West Coast papers a week or more ago about Brian Wilson being missing from a Beach Boys reunion show that took place in Lake Tahoe. And he had no contractual obligation to be at that reunion, and he wasn't anywhere. He was just home. He was over at a mutual friend's house, David Leaf, for dinner on New Year's Day. And the following day, he had friends over to his house for, like a football party watching TV. And he got a call from a friend of his saying, "Hey, Brian, you're missing." I mean, I think that people are a little too presumptuous anymore. I understand it, and I certainly don't fault people for it, but I think they're too quick to feed into the negative aspects of the Brian Wilson myth as a kind of a hapless figure at this point.
Your book is as much about the Beach Boys' father, Murray Wilson, as it is about the boys themselves. He wanted them to be child stars?
He wanted them to be child stars, and he wanted them to make his sort of unfulfilled dream come true.
What was that dream?
He wanted to be a songwriter and an entrepreneur in terms of a kind of a, you know, entertainment impresario. And when he saw the talent they had, he set aside, for the most part, his own songwriting ambitions. He returned to them later, but he set them aside to be a promoter of the Beach Boys, and in many cases he did a pretty good job. He was an uncommonly aggressive guy, but that aggressive attitude took a toll on the boys themselves and their first cousin and their best friend, Al Jardine.
My guest is Timothy White, author of The Nearest Faraway Place, Brian Wilson, The Beach Boys, and the Southern California Experience. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys with Timothy White.
One of the things you try to do in your new book is to see how the Beach Boys actually connected with surf culture. I mean, they became famous for their surf songs. What's your explanation for how Brian Wilson, with his fear of the ocean, ended up writing all these important surf songs?
What happened, and it was this was a family kind of a thing, too. Dennis Wilson, Brian's brother, was a loner. And I got to know Dennis Wilson very well over the years. And he was really a searching and kind of unfinished personality. But he used to go down to the beach to sort of hang out as like a teenage vagabond or whatever. But the beach culture at that point in time, the late 50s and early 60s, and surfing was a big part of it. It wasn't this sportive, healthy, sun-kissed outdoor activity that people perceive it as now. As people that I talked to, the early surfers like the late Dewey Weber, explained to me, surf culture at that point in time took a lot of skill to surf, and it was especially hard because they were still surfing on the old hardwood boards and things like that. But more particularly, it was a kind of a vagrant culture in a way, really on the fringes of towns that were very tough, marginal towns in Southern California to begin with. And a lot of people hanging out on the beach, the beachcombers, they were AWOL from the Army. They were on the lam from, unhappy lives elsewhere. And they were really, it was an improvised culture on the beach and very much a bohemian nomad kind of a thing. And Dennis got to know it because of his own sense of being an outcast. And then he'd come back to Brian and to Mike Love, who later on surfed, as Dennis did, and explain his experiences and say, there's something going on here that you guys aren't really aware of, and it's really, really cool. But they didn't pay attention until it came down to specific moments in the studio when they were auditioning for people and showing what they had cooked up as a group, and people weren't terribly impressed, and Dennis stood up and said, surfing is a big thing. What if we did a song about surfing? Brian has this surf tune he's been working on. And they all turned to Dennis, meaning the band turned to Dennis, kind of gaping. And this was not Brian's ambition for himself. He wanted to be the next sort of pop Gershwin. And he wasn't interested in surfing. As you say, he was afraid of the water, had no interest in wave riding, didn't care to learn, wasn't interested in the bohemian culture that Dennis was kind of meandering through. But when he saw the reaction that other people had to Dennis's suggestions, he started to take it seriously.
Well, you actually brought with you a rehearsal session. I believe it's a rehearsal session that the Beach Boys did. Maybe you could play some of that for us and talk with us a little about what you think we might listen for in it.
This is an outtake from the Beach Boys' Party album. The Beach Boys are playing California Girls, Hootenanny style, and it's one of the rehearsal sessions for that Beach Boys' Party album, which was very important because it was the first time that a hugely important rock and roll band had let the public in on its private process and the interpersonal sense they had with each other.
Let's hear it.
And the northern girls with the way they kiss, they keep their boyfriends warm at night. Wish they all could be California. Wish they all could be California. Wish they all could be California girls.
You gonna keep on singing after that?
Okay, rolling.
Sorry, let's just do it.
No, it's interesting to hear that. Some of Brian Wilson's best songs are not about the surf culture, but they're songs about, a lonely guy in his room or somebody pining for a lost love, somebody feeling hurt and alone. Was it hard for him to get away from that surf persona and write from a more personal point of view? I mean, hard for him to get that recorded or get it accepted?
It took time. Brian was amazingly prolific, but he never wrote about who he was. He wrote about who he wanted to be. And that was his natural impulse, to take himself to a better place, to a more edifying place. And a lot of these songs about hot rods and surfing, they were fun, mostly because a whole group of people grew up around the process. And Brian was used to songwriting being very lonesome, very isolated, and he saw it didn't need to be that way. And that was fun. Unfortunately, the pressure at that time to crank out more and more of these surf and hot rod hits really became oppressive. This was a point in time when a group like the Beach Boys on Capitol could release 3-4 albums in a given year. That was a common thing. It's not the way we know it now, where people put an album out once every 2 years or 3 years. The amount of songs that Brian wrote and produced, it was just, it's staggering. And in the book, the anecdotal circumstances of all of them are explained.
When the Beach Boys started recording, they were perceived as, you know, helping to define a certain aspect of surf culture. How were their records actually seen within surf culture in California?
They were admired for their harmonies. People liked the ballads. They were a well-regarded band, and they played at the local surf hops and things like that. But you got to understand that in most cases, the surfers themselves weren't making music. An exception is this fella, Dick Dale. He had a group called Dick Dale and the Deltones. He was a surfer. He had a guitar and stereo repair shop. But most surf music, as played by people like Dick Dale, they were instrumentals. They were very aggressive, almost caustic. Volume was a big factor, and they wanted to replicate the sound of the waves, the sensation of surfing. They weren't looking for pop ballads, per se. So the Beach Boys brought something pretty to something that was kind of less pristine.
Now, you've brought with you a tape of a forthcoming CD. Introduce it for us. Tell us something about it.
It's a song called This Could Be the Night, and it's a tribute album to the late Harry Nilsson, you know, another pop songwriter based in Southern California who contributed a lot to that whole school of rock and roll. And it's interesting how much Brian can sound like the Beach Boys. When he made the Pet Sounds album, he made it largely on his own. And that's not necessarily a knock of the Beach Boys, because their sound belongs to the rest of them every bit as much as it does Brian. But it shows how successful Brian was as a kind of an auteur, and the fact that he understood and continues to understand the elements that make his music work best, even when he's working with someone else's song, in this case, Harry Nilsson's song.
Well, Timothy White, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Timothy White is the author of the new book, The Nearest Faraway Place, Brian Wilson, The Beach Boys, and the Southern California Experience. He's editor-in-chief at Billboard Magazine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. And here's music, new music, by Brian Wilson from a forthcoming CD.
All these nights we've been away, all these nights we've been a day, something tells me the time is getting right. But each time the kiss takes a little bit longer, till my love gets a little bit stronger, and I feel like I'm sitting on dynamite.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional funding is provided by Random House, publisher of The Paperboy, the new novel from Paris Trout author Pete Dexter. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we talk with Ed Zwick, the co-creator of the TV series My So-Called Life and 30-something. He also directed Glory, about a black battalion in the Civil War, and the new film, The Legends of the Fall. The rules of grammar drive many of us crazy. Linguist Jeff Nunberg tells us why adverbs drive linguists crazy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ed Zwick is the co-founder of the production company Bedford Falls that created the TV series My So-Called Life and 30-something. Although his TV shows are famous for reflecting contemporary life, a couple of his movies are set in the past. He directed the film Glory, about an African-American battalion that fought in the Civil War. His new film, Legends of the Fall, is set in an earlier part of this century. It's about a cavalry officer, played by Anthony Hopkins, who resigns from his post in anger over the government's treatment of Native Americans. He lives in Montana, where he brings up his three sons, played by Aidan Quinn, Brad Pitt, and Henry Thomas. Early in the film, the sons go off to Europe to fight in World War I. Zwick staged battle scenes for the new film and for Glory. I asked Zwick about shooting the World War I scenes in Legends. In these scenes, men appear to be blown into the air by explosives.
Those guys who take those falls, there's something called an air ram, which is a charge in a kind of pneumatic step that has to be hit at just the right angle and an impact, and then it launches guys. And it is keyed, wired to an explosive, which is in the foreground, so that as that stuntman steps on that air ram, the charge goes off. You know, the ram is masked, so you don't see it, and so he goes at the same time the charge goes. But some of those guys you see flung into the air are dummies. Uh-huh. We carefully, you know, salted in dummies who could then be, you know, tossed in a much more random and what would be quite dangerous way, and yet because with the trickery of sound and the sleight of hand of combining them with real people, you presume them to be men.
The Civil War battle scenes in Glory must have been so interesting for you to shoot, because it's, you know, it's incomprehensible to me. I don't know if you feel this way. It's incomprehensible to me that men could have gone into battle standing in straight lines firing at each other.
Well, that to me was the purpose of shooting those scenes, you know, was to try to, I mean, the purpose of that movie was some exploration of what might have been in the minds of those men who did that. You know, what could have motivated them? What was it about that age or that moment in history that might have engendered that? It was very important to try to show those tactics and try to explain just how proximate those distances and, you know, but like Glory, what happened in World War I was that suddenly there had been a leap in technology, and that had outstripped the tactics. You know, the sudden in Glory, the rifled barrel suddenly made weapons accurate to within much greater distances than the tactics had ever prepared them. It was the moment in which the god of infantry died, really, you know, overtaken by the god of artillery, I guess.
Did you go back and watch a lot of movie war scenes before shooting your own?
I went back when I shot Glory, and I looked at a movie called Ron by Kurosawa, a movie that I desperately loved, and nobody does that better than he.
Oh, God, that's spectacular.
Yeah, really, yeah. Just an unbelievable. And by the way, he does with very little, as I had to. It's all done in the camera. It's done with kinetics and filling the frame, and it's not done with huge numbers or huge resources. And to me, that's even more extraordinary as part of its accomplishment. And for this movie, I did go back and look at the milestone All Quiet on the Western Front, because, you know, when they made that movie, they were so much closer to the events of the day, and I knew that they would have been working with consultants and men who had actually been there and done it, and so that what you saw in that movie had to have been the closest to an evocation of what it was really like. In addition to which, there's actually footage available from the First World War of some battle scenes, and I obviously looked at that as well.
Glory was about the 54th Regiment of the Massachusetts Volunteer Army Infantry. It was a black battalion during the Civil War. Did you get any flack for being a white person directing a film about such an important part of African American history?
You know, I didn't. At a certain moment, I had some representative come talk to me from the Black Caucus. They felt they wanted to have some input in it, and I listened, I wasn't necessarily influenced by anything they said or didn't say. They tend to be very, you know, positive about the movie, and ultimately we got what's called the Image Award from the NAACP. So they obviously felt the same way. But you know, I should be able to do that in the same way that John Singleton should be able to do an A.R. Gurney play. I mean, directing certainly I think can be colorblind. I mean, George Wolfe is running the public theater, and his themes and subjects are by no means limited by his color. I had trepidation about telling Morgan Freeman and Denzel Washington and Andre Brower and trying to lead them through the emotional, you know, arcs of things that they knew much better than I and clearly had real feeling about. But you know what? It was done with humor. Their generosity was extraordinary. It turns out, in fact, that for them to affect some of those mannerisms and feelings, those ancestral, you know, generational ones, are not dissimilar from how easily I can fall into the sort of Yiddishkeit rhythms of my grandfather and relatives from the shtetl.
So give me an example of something that could have been uncomfortable but wasn't, because, as you said, everybody handled it with good humor.
Well, I mean, I'm doing rewrites of speeches, and I'm giving them words on the page that say, you know, ain't much a matter about tomorrow, we be men, you know. And I'm afraid that I'm going to be, you know, damned by some, you know, movie god. And instead, you know, Morgan will look at that and say, well, I don't know if it should be... ain't much matter. I think it ain't matter much. You know, it becomes just, I can't really remember a lot of specifics, except that there's shame and embarrassment on all sides when you're doing stuff as sensitive as that. And the way that you handle those feelings is often with humor.
How did you get to direct Glory?
I got very lucky. I'd made a movie for TriStar that made some money. I made a movie called About Last Night that was made for $8 million and made 40 or 50, and they were interested in me doing another one, and they had already paid me. So they still weren't convinced. A guy named Jeff Sagansky, who's now back at TriStar, had been in a history class with me in college, as it turned out, and I knew that he had a passion for history. I did something very smart. I got them to give me $35,000, and I and two cameramen and Freddie Fields went to a reenactment. It was the July 4th reenactment of the 125th anniversary of Gettysburg, and we went there, and we shot a bunch of film, and I put it together in a kind of a 3 or 4 minute little reel, and I took music from Morricone or something and put it together, and they looked at that, and they went, oh my goodness, I guess we're already making this movie. I just kept it going from there.
My guest is Ed Zwick, director of Glory and the new film Legends of the Fall. He co-created the TV series My So-Called Life and 30-something. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Ed Zwick is my guest, and he directed the new film Legends of the Fall. Your production company does My So-Called Life. How's the show doing?
Well, it's doing well in the hearts and minds of those who watch it, and not well enough for the network's bottom line concerns. It's odd to talk about something as being marginal when it's being seen weekly by 11 or 12 million people, but you know they have some very specific economic dictates about ad dollars and revenues and rating points, and we're not yet at that critical mass to really satisfy them. And I think its fate is very much in the balance.
So the show's in trouble.
I think so. Yeah, we'll be on the air 2 more weeks. We've shot 2 more episodes, and then that will have been 19, which is almost a full season. And then we'll go on, you know, that quaint phrase of hiatus until May, when they will decide its fate, and it will either return next fall or not.
What do you know about who's watching it? You know, adults, teenagers.
Well, I think we're damned by our time slot. You know, we have the great misfortune of working with a network that's doing well. And that means they have less opportunity to put us in the right place. We're on at 8 o'clock, and consequently, we're getting an 8 o'clock audience. I get the feeling that about 8 or 9 million young women between 12 and 18 are watching the show, but their parents aren't, because they perceive it to be something that's not for them because it's on at that hour, or they are too busy putting their kids to bed, or they are still unwinding from a difficult day and not yet ready to sit down and watch something challenging, which they tend to do at 9 or 10 o'clock, which is where the show should be.
And you think it's not there because there's too many other shows that want that real estate?
Well, they already have claim on the real estate, and they're already profitable in those those situations. And there's a very interesting thing happening at ABC particularly, which is a kind of a turf warfare, I think, between the network and the news division. All these magazine shows, which are doing less well now, but you know they are cheaper, they were profitable, and they have a commitment and a very strong advocate in Rune Arledge over there. And so I think there's some real tension.
Now your company produces the series. What kind of leverage does that give you with the network?
Little and none, I think. I have the leverage of the high moral ground about a piece that I know they like, and maybe even more ardently than that, love. They have children who watch it, and they watch it and know its value. And I think the only reason that it is still on the air is because of that belief in its quality and its value that is maybe a little bit more ineffable than in dollars and cents.
When My So-Called Life was being created, what did you want out of it? In other words, what did you want the show to say about teenage life and family life and how that compares from the teenager's point of view and the parents' point of view?
Mm-hmm. I think it has at its base something quite political, which is a validation of the inner life of teenagers. You know, I was just sickened unto death of this kind of exploitative, objectified portrayal of adolescence. You know, they're described from the outside out in, you know, and it's about what, you know, this kind of imagined applique of teen fun. And I'm sorry, but that was not my experience of adolescence, nor that of most people that I know. So we really wanted to give a voice to those issues of identity and alienation and individuation and God knows all those words, that hadn't necessarily been done before.
One of the things I like about this series is that I find myself both, you know, relating to and also getting, sometimes annoyed with each of the characters. Do you know what I mean? There's things I like about them and things that I don't, which strikes me as, pretty real, I guess.
Well, that's a fair comment and one that we're aware of. I mean, I think when we first did Even 30-something, I think initially people were taking things so straight and unaware of our own understanding of these characters' flaws. I mean, I don't know about you, but I love my friends for their flaws as well as for their qualities. And I guess in our portrayal of these characters, it's much more interesting to talk about what someone whom you love is doing wrong, or rather is errant in some way, and watching them muddle their way through, as we all do, than trying to present characters as somehow exemplary, because that's boring.
Let me go back a bit and ask you about 30-something. How did the series end? Was it your idea to end it, or the network's?
It was ours.
Why did you know the time was up?
I think we had we were in risk of repeating ourselves. I think we had set out to write about a world of concerns, and we had mouthed off about each one, and we were, as artists, all of us, growing very tired and even a little bit bored. And I just, you know, my instincts are always to, you know, get out with one less curtain call and leave people wanting more, rather than overstaying a welcome. I'd seen too many shows just ground down and betray a promise. And we had made a certain promise of a certain level, and with great exception, we kept to it, or at least tried to. And it was time.
Ed Zwick directed the new film Legends of the Fall and co-created the TV series My So-Called Life and 30-something. This is Fresh Air. The Russians are shelling Grozny again. Linda Wertheimer is with us. Linda, what will you have on that on All Things Considered?
We talked to a correspondent who's just come out of there, Terry, and he said shells are falling at the rate of 10 a minute in a very heavy bombardment, and there are reports that an invasion is to follow. We also have a report that a daughter of Malcolm X has been indicted in Chicago in a conspiracy plot to murder Louis Farrakhan. Ted Clark is going to take a look at why Americans at the moment seem to hate the government. NOAA, the National Oceans and Atmospheric Association, is meeting on long-term weather forecasts, and apparently they say rain in California's future big time.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Some rules of grammar are supposed to be sacred, even though they drive linguists crazy, linguists like our commentator Jeffrey Nunberg.
I don't like to think about adverbs too much. I get depressed. You know what adverbs remind me of is the borough of Queens. There was a study that the psychologist Stanley Milgram did about 20 years ago where he showed New Yorkers photographs of various parts of the city and asked them where they thought they were taken. It turned out that whenever they weren't sure, they tend to say, I don't know, what is that, Queens? Well, the adverb is the queens of grammar. What do you say about the word ago, for example? Well, it's obviously not a noun or verb, and it doesn't feel much like an adjective. And it can't be a preposition because everybody knows that preposition means put before, and ago is put after. So put it in the adverb pile. Nobody ever looks there anyway. And that's how it's labeled in every dictionary, along with a bunch of other words that seem to have nothing at all in common, quickly and very and aboard and nonetheless. The dictionaries even tell you that the word the is an adverb in a phrase like the more the merrier. It sounds like something out of a story by Borges, like a medieval encyclopedia that groups all the animals into four classes, the ones that walk, the ones that crawl, the ones that jump, and the ones that burrow, fly, or swim. And in fact, the story we learn in school about the parts of speech is a vestige of the grammatical theory of the early Middle Ages, which held that the parts of speech were keys to God's ordained order of the universe. Philosophically, the view went underground around the time of Pierre Abelard and William of Ockham, but it has survived over the succeeding eight centuries in the oral lore of the classroom. All of this drives linguists crazy. They have their own modern theories of grammar with their own exotic categories. The is a determiner. Ago is a postposition. Nonetheless is a sentential adjunct. But educators and even lexicographers prefer the categories they learned under Sister Petra's ruler. And I suppose I can understand their point of view. After all, the study of grammar has always been invested with a mysterious power to shape the mind and the soul. As one 19th century educator put it, it's an employment calculated to exclude those frivolous pursuits, that love of ease and sensual pleasure, which enfeeble and corrupt the minds of many inconsiderate youth and render them useless to society. Now, these are not the sorts of claims that anybody would make for chemistry or astronomy, and it would be silly to make them for modern linguistic theories of grammar as well. Of course, there are people who say that school grammar is an exercise in the absurd. You take an arbitrary set of premises, and you follow them through to their conclusions, taking no prisoners along the way. Take the sort of reasoning you have to go through to come up with the conclusion that the is an adverb in a phrase like the more the merrier. You say, well, more is an adjective, and the modifies more, and an adverb is anything that modifies a verb or an adjective or another adverb, so the must be an adverb here. Now, if you were looking at this with a cool eye of science, you'd say, but that's crazy. There must be something wrong with the theory. But it's just this sort of grammatical reasoning that we want for the trials of ordinary experience. You call up the airline and you say, look, if you charge $550 for a flight from San Francisco to Atlanta that stops in Dallas, I don't see how you can charge $750 just to fly from San Francisco to Dallas. And if they have their wits about them, they answer you, well, with all respect, sir, you're no grammarian. Nietzsche saw all the tricks of grammar and despaired of them. Reason in language, he said. Oh, what a deceptive old woman she is. I am afraid we'll never get rid of our belief in God because we still have faith in grammar. But of course, that's just why the defenders of the old order cling to traditional grammar so tenaciously. Let people once doubt the reality of adverbs, and it's only a short step to doubting the reality of the unquestioned categories of experience, God, excursion fairs, even the borough of Queens.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist with Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Nancy Updike. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.